Hello, and welcome to The Rundown, a podcast from Politics Home. I'm your host, Alan Tolhurst, and this week, as we head into a general election year, we're taking a look at the state of democracy in the UK. From the campaigns to alter our voting system, to controversial new rules on voter ID, changes on how much parties can spend, transparency, and what can be improved before Brits head to the polls sometime in 2024. With me to look at all that and more, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Jess Garland, Director of Policy and Research at the Electoral Reform Society, Naomi Smith, CEO at the campaign group Best for Britain, and Alistair Carmichael, former Cabinet Minister and Liberal Democrat MP. So I'll start with you, Naomi. I'm going to ask each of you really what the kind of key area of kind of democratic deficit that you guys are interested in and what you think needs to be really improved before we get to an election at whatever time of the year we do end up going to the polls.
I can't be quick with that answer.
Okay,
I mean, we need so much democratic renewal. There is often a very big focus on the voting system, and Best for Britain has campaigned for a change to that, to something that makes votes a little bit more equal than they are at the moment, but it would be a necessary but insufficient part of the whole scale constitutional reform we need at the moment. You know, trust in politics is incredibly low, and in no small part that is related to things like unelected power, dodgy money being poured into our voting systems, etc., etc. So PR, proportional representation, is a big area of focus for us, but it is by no means the only thing I think we would need going into these elections, which of course won't be under PR, nor will other elections happening this year like mayoral elections, because now they will also for the first time be fought under a first-past-the-post system. It surely is about people being turned away at the polling station for the first time because they don't know that they need photographic ID, and not only that, they need very specific forms of photographic ID. So for listeners' benefit, one example before I let you ask somebody else: a young person's Oyster card would not be valid, an older person's Oyster card would be valid. Who benefits from that? I'll leave listeners to make their minds up about.
Well, actually, we'll come into that, I suppose, with Jacob Rees-Mogg made some kind of revealing comments about kind of voter ID, which we'll come on to later. Alistair, I'll go to you next. You were nodding your head along with the
I fear we're going to have a lot of violent agreement.
That's all right. We're fine to have that on this podcast. That's good.
But then again, you know, if you want consensus in politics, maybe that's not a bad thing. Look, if we could only do one thing, then it would have to be electoral reform. It has to be moving to a proportional voting system, because continuing to work with a voting system that concentrates absolute power in the hands of about 40% of the population then opens the door to all the things that we're going to talk about. The raise in the spending limits. So, you know, just before Christmas, the government doubled the amount of money that parties can spend in a national campaign, and they're spending it already. Yeah. You know, they may be politically bankrupt, but the Tories are still awash with cash. And you saw in the Mirror at the weekend, the Rishi Sunak's Facebook page ads are already outspending Donald Trump's by some significant margin. So, you know, follow the money. It's not difficult to find out. But change the voting system first. The other thing I think, and this comes back to what Naomi's saying about faith in politics and the rest of it, if all you do is change the voting system, then you miss the trick. Actually, what we really need to do is pull the holding of power from the dead cold fingers of ministers and civil servants in Whitehall and in Edinburgh, Cardiff, Belfast, and push it out to the communities. Because, you know, I agree with much of what Naomi said, just about everything she said, but from a different perspective. You know, so in Scotland since 1999, we have had a parliament elected by proportional representation, but in the last 10 plus years, that parliament has ruthlessly centralised control in Edinburgh. It has laid waste to local government in Scotland. So voting systems and the rest of it only take you so far. It's not just about how you elect your parliament, your government, it's what they then do with the power when they have it.
All power corrupts, huh?
And absolute power is even more fun, I think, how it goes on.
And Jess, for you guys at the ERS, what are you guys, I guess obviously PR has been a big thing for you guys as well, but what else are you guys looking at
Yeah, of course PR is huge, but it's all connected, right? I mean, when we think about what are the problems that we have a problem of young people not engaging in politics in massive numbers. The turnout gap between generations has got huge over recent years. Young people more likely to turn to populist leaders and more likely to be polarised. These are the big threats to our democracy, which are coming thick and fast, and we can't ignore them. And all the things we've mentioned here are about giving people more of a say and actually giving people that power back. So, and I would agree with Alistair, we do concentrate power massively in this country, but it's not really in that 40%, it's in one person, right? So we need to think about what's the structure, and there's lots of assets that. So people know that when they go to vote for lots of people, it's not making a huge difference. People also see money coming into politics from a handful of individuals, you know, throwing, you know, millions at our political system. And we also see, you know, people getting into the House of Lords for very dubious reasons. You know, there's so many aspects of our system, which when you look at it, it says to people, Your voice isn't as important as others. And that's what, for me, is really at the heart of all these changes.
And 40% is on a good day. I mean, Labour got just over 35% in 2005, yet total power of government.
Yeah, there's quite a menu for us to get into. But if we're starting with the voting system, I think 2015 was, for me, the most egregious example of how first past the post can really, together, the Liberal Democrats, UKIP and the Greens got almost 25% of all the votes cast, 7.4 million votes. But they just got just 10 seats between them. You know, they were having 750,000 votes per seat, whereas the Tories got 11.3 million votes and got 330 seats. So just 35,000 votes per seat. I guess the paradox is that you need to have a government with a big majority to push through something like change the system. But as soon as you've got a big majority, you think, well, actually, we probably don't need to reform the system. So how do we kind of move towards that? And also, what system can we? Obviously, we've had things like AV Plus and the additional vote and all that kind of stuff in other places, in mayoral elections in Scotland. You know, what is the system you think that would get most kind of support, and how do we move towards that, do you think?
When we think about how do we get there, well, it is already popular with voters. We've polled it at Best for Britain, not very recently, but a year ago or so, and we had, you know, 45% of people supporting PR, just 30% first past the post, but a chunky don't know, because let's face it, most people just don't have the time to think about.
No, and they either go to the ballot box once every 5 years, exactly, and it's the only system they've ever known.
Yeah. So even though actually, you know, voters cope with it incredibly well, and, you know, when it's in a mayoral election or a parliamentary election in Scotland or Wales and Northern Ireland. So we will probably have a change of government this year. And if the polls are to be believed, it will be a Labour-led government. And Labour have got this incredible tradition of electoral reform. They also pertain to be very much the party of equality. Their members have overwhelmingly backed PR at conferences. Their major affiliated unions have adopted it as a policy position. And the Labour Party have done it. I mean, it was the Labour Party in the 70s that introduced PR for European elections in Northern Ireland. It was a Labour-led government that, when setting up the devolved assemblies, gave them proportionate voting systems for elections to them. It was Blair that introduced the de Hondt method for voting in European elections, which is a more proportionate system. So they've done it before. They should do it again, but you're right. It's incredibly difficult to see a situation where the current parliamentary Labour Party will do that, particularly with a large majority. You know, Turkey's voting for Christmas is often the phrase, but the choice for them is you can either be in opposition most of the time, as they were most of the time in the 20th century, or they can be the largest party in government under a proportionate system most of the time. That's the choice they have to make.
Yeah, and Jess, obviously, Keir Starmer commissioned Gordon Brown to look into kind of constitutional reform, but it looks as though that sort of thing that gets, it's been talked about as it being a sort of second term issue, which we kind of know is code word for it being kicked into the long grass and never really happening. And I suppose they're going to inherit, if they do win the election, inherit a country with a lot of problems, economic, social, all that kind of stuff. And this kind of stuff often gets pushed down the pecking order. You know, can you give us the argument for why it would be so important for them to focus on that and to make that kind of a core part of their offer to the public? And also, again, what sort of system do you think they could use as part of that?
I mean, I think Labour's answered that question for itself, you know, through the Brown Commission, which is basically saying we want big economic change. We want to equal across the country, level up, to use that phrase. And through the Brown Commission, they said in order to do that levelling up, you need to change power at the centre, and you need to let go of power and make sure every community has the power to, you know, have their own economic growth. Now, for me, Labour's already set out why you need to do the democratic bit alongside, you know, the economic bit. But it's actually seeing that through. And as Alistair touched on, at all levels, but it has to start. And Andy Burnham makes this point very clearly. It has to start with reform at Westminster, because you can't do it without a serious look at power at Westminster. And were you to bring in PR, I mean, we don't have to go back to the drawing board on this. We have systems that have a long history within the British Isles that many voters, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland are already familiar with. And there's two main types of system.
They insult the intelligence of voters all the time with that, oh, it's complicated. Voters don't find it complicated.
I can confirm this. I elect my councillors in Orkney using single transferable votes. So when I go into the polling booth, I put my preference 1, 2, 3, 4, however far. Now, I'm never going to be a chartered accountant or an economist, but I can manage this, you know. And I've never heard anybody of my friends or neighbours or family saying they can.
As can people who take part in internal party elections.
Indeed,
in the Labour Party.
In the Labour Party.
They use proportionate systems.
I mean, if the essay question here is how do we shift the Labour Party on this? From my long experience of dealing with the Labour Party, there are two ways you can shift them. First of all, you can persuade them according to the high principles and the sense of fairness and what is good and right for the country, or else you can appeal to naked self-interest. And, you know, look, sometimes one works better than the other. But you said right there, and it was a very telling phrase, this is a second term issue. Bluntly, the Labour Party, if they form the next government as a majority or a minority, have got a job of work to do that makes the economic reconstruction that was facing us in 2010 look like a Sunday school picnic. If they do not have a proportional system by the next election, there will not be a second term. We see at the moment what the right-wing press is capable of doing. If the Labour Party is left having to clear up the mess that the Conservatives have created with Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng in their mini-budget, then frankly, they'll be lucky to go one term, let alone get a second.
Before we move on to other issues, you obviously, not to bring up the AV, and then you were in government when there was the last time that we did seriously at the country look at changing the voting system, and there was the referendum on moving to AV. What are your recollections of that and why it went quite badly for your side, unfortunately?
My recollections are
recollections
probably,
may vary, I suppose.
Probably not for a family podcast, but I learned from it. As is always the danger with referendums in a parliamentary system, it can become about all sorts of things other than the question that's on the ballot paper. And I think that was a big part of it.
Yeah.
But on this occasion, I'm actually quite happy to take my lead from the Conservative Party. Because the Conservatives, as Naomi touched on, have changed the system for the London Assembly, for the mayoral elections, police and crime commissioners, whoever else, and have introduced electoral reform without recourse to a referendum. I'm quite happy to follow their lead.
And Welsh Labour have as well, you know, in one parliamentary term pushed through reform in the first term. It can be done. It can be done within a Labour-led government.
We went to single transferable vote for Scottish council elections without any question of a referendum. So I think that would be something which ultimately probably would be an unnecessary distraction.
Yeah, Jess, obviously, there are some critics of PR. I know that, obviously, I think the Belarus is perhaps the only other European country that uses first past the post. But so lots of other countries do use it, but there's criticism that it gives, you know, a voice to sort of fringe far-right parties and extremism and stuff. What are the kind of the issues, I suppose, with first past the post, you know, in terms of the deficit that it creates and why it's so important to move to a more proportional system, even if it does open the door to those parties at the edges that are currently squeezed out by first past the post?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting way of putting it, because of course we should be thinking about what are the issues we have here right now in front of us with first past
rather
the
than
post.
Criticizing the potential systems in the future, right?
Absolutely. And I always think when people sort of say about the far right, look to Scotland and Wales, and perhaps we can say, you know, are the British people just sat there waiting for the right system in order to vote in far right parties? I do not believe that is the case. I actually think when you look at the real situation and what we've experienced in the last 6 years is with a majoritarian system, when you're facing infiltration or small minor views, far more dangerous, right? They can easily swing your whole political system towards a minority within existing parties rather than having to have a spread of views and having to compromise and negotiate, which is a normal part of politics. And actually, that is far better out in the open where people can see it than behind closed doors, which is a real risk under our
country. You talk about entryism and infiltration. Look at the way the Conservative Party has changed since 2016. You know, and the other argument used to be, well, it gives you strong, stable government. Well, you know, in the last 4 years, we've had three prime ministers.
Yeah.
So I think we can now well and truly bury that idea and put a headstone on it.
And I think it's about power. That's what it fundamentally comes back to. And under proportionate system, while fringe parties may get some representation, the odds of them getting 100% executive power as a first-past-the-post system delivers is nil. Is highly, highly unlikely. Whereas we've got this bastardised approach at the moment where you have parties that don't have any elected representatives. I'm looking at the Brexit Party, I'm looking at now Reform UK, having an enormous influence on the party that does have 100% control of the executive in this country. So first past the post is also delivering some pretty extreme policy shifts from the governing party as a consequence of this sort of broad coalition they're trying to hold together. When we look at European elections that are elected under proportionate systems and where you do get far right, far left representation there, when you rerun those electoral results under a first-past-the-post system, they are much more shocking and terrifying.
Well, let's move on to one of the changes that is coming in this year with voter ID. You touched on it at the start, and the government brought it in the teeth of a lot of criticism that essentially it was, you know, broadly using a kind of a sledgehammer to crack a nut. They suggested it's going to stop electoral fraud, but actually the fear is that there's very little amounts of fraud, but essentially it's that the fear is it's going to disenfranchise an awful lot of people, and as you touched on at the start, perhaps more disenfranchise young people who are less likely to vote anyway. We heard Jacob Rees-Mogg actually saying that when it was used, voter ID was used in the local elections last year, that actually it was older people who don't routinely carry ID normally because they never had to, they were actually the ones who were being turned away, and so perhaps there were some unintended consequences for it as we go forward. What have you kind of made of the voter ID experiment so far, and what are your kind of fears as it gets rolled out for a general election?
Let us be clear, whether it's young people, old people, people inclined to vote for progressive left parties, people inclined to vote for any disenfranchisement in a modern democracy is unacceptable and wrong. When we look at the impact that we know of from the elections that have been held so far where ID have been required, official numbers saying that about 14,000 people were prevented from voting in 2023 in local elections, and that's Electoral Commission data. And if you extrapolate that, you're looking at between 80 and 100,000 voters potentially being turned away at a general election, and that's based on how many people turned out in 2019. I think that's a really conservative estimate because it's based on the people who were actually turned away.
Yeah,
it doesn't include
didn't even bother to turn
the people
out.
Who didn't even have the right ID or realised they needed it and left the queue before anyone clocked them. So it's potentially a much, much, much larger issue, and certainly far greater numbers than have ever been caught having done any kind of electoral fraud. So I think potentially very, very large. This election is so different from any other that I can remember in my life because we have every single party leader is new compared to last time. Every constituency is going to be new. You're going to be, you know, voting potentially in a different place. You know, where they vote is different. Now, even their polling station may be different because the school is crumbling with concrete that's decaying and has been closed and who knows where the polling station is, and are you going to be bothered to find out that it isn't where it usually is and where the new one is?
Can the council afford to staff them? Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Well, that's an entire podcast on its own. And then you've got to bring the right ID with you. You've got to know to do that. You've potentially got to pay something to get that ID. You don't. There is a form you can fill out on the government website. And I would urge all listeners to make sure they and everyone eligible to vote
in their house. The uptake of that free ID has been pretty low so far, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's actually quite a clumsy form. I sort of mystery shopped it and tried to fill it out. It's not actually that easy. And so I think the potential is really, really huge. And, you know, if you just forget it on the day, and then are you, you know, if we are looking at an autumn slash winter election. It's going to be dark, it's going to be cold, it's going to be wet. People are busy, they're time poor. Are they really going to go home, grab the right stuff and come back again?
Yeah, you isolate that one bit of the day when you can go out and vote.
Exactly. So, you know, if listeners do want alerts, if they do want to be reminded about all of this, you can go to getvoting.org. We'll fire out reminders to you at all the relevant dates. Probably worth doing a postal vote if you think that you aren't going to have time on the day or there's any risk that you might not. Jess has already talked about the turnout gap between older and younger voters. This is only going to make any barrier to entry to the democratic decision-making process is a bad thing.
Yeah, Alistair, your opposition to things like the stuff during the COVID pandemic, you know, having to, you know, not being a papers please country, and this is kind of the worst version of that for you. You must have been an absolute nightmare when you saw this proposal coming through.
Yeah, I mean, look, this kind of goes to my sort of political core about defining that relationship between the citizen and the state, and that right to say, you know, your papers please is something that just kind of gets right to me. And it's not actually just the papers please bit, it's the fact that in this day and age it comes with a register of identity, it comes with a database underpinning it of where you've used it and when.
Yep.
And that's the whole purpose of electoral ID. Civil servants love this, they're desperate to get more of it, and instinctively I just don't want to know anything else. So I'm afraid I see this very much as the thin end of a big dangerous wedge.
Yeah.
But, you know, get away from that. It is just a solution to a problem that's not there.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen some electoral fraud. We've seen it in certain parts of London. But that wasn't people turning up.
No, it's broadly postal voting, wasn't it?
It was postal voting. Actually, the increase in postal voting is a good thing. It opens the access to the election. It makes actual electoral administration in places like mine, because Orkney, Shetland, Western Isles, no change in the
boundaries. Yeah, that's a protected constituency up there. Yeah.
But outside the mainland, in Orkney and in Shetland, everybody, or certainly in Orkney, everybody votes by post.
Yeah.
Now, they still have the right to attend a polling station on mainland Orkney if they choose to, but actually you see a much better turnout in those areas that are entirely down to postal voting.
Yeah, just kind of on this, and there was criticism as it came in from figures like Alistair and people like Kat Smith, the Labour MP, really focus on it. And I wonder, have they learned any lessons from the way when we saw it coming? Obviously, it'll be used in the by-elections that's happening as well. Is there going to be any changes, do you think, to the voter ID system before the general election, perhaps changing, tweaking some of those IDs, the forms of IDs that are usable, as Naomi mentioned, that, or are they going to just push through with it as it is, do you think?
Well, the Electoral Commission report that came out said that it's absolutely critical that changes are made before the next election and before the next general election particularly. But then we saw the government's own analysis, which seemed to really paint a much rosier picture than everything else. Things like the LGRU's report, which said that electoral administrators were struggling to recruit people to staff polling stations, that people were dropping out because of the rules. All that kind of the warning signs seem to be being brushed under the carpet. And there are lots and lots of ways. Like, we'd like to see this scrapped, as Naomi said, what was the point of it in the first place? But there are ways where you could sort of, you know, take the edge off a little bit, mitigate some of the worst impacts by expanding the list of IDs that people could bring. You know, let people just bring along their ballot card, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, let's have an issue that's in proportion to the issue. Or, you know, have people on the day, someone can vouch for them. That's used in Canada. So loads of things that could be done and could be done before the election, but I've seen no sign of the government taking this as seriously as it should be.
Well, the kind of the other big issue that we touched upon, we'll go into now, is kind of the changes to spending rules that were kind of slipped out after the autumn statement at the end of last year. The national spending cap is going to go rising, I think, by 80%. The current limit is £19.5 million. It's going to go up to £35 million, which is going to be the most expensive election ever in the UK. And I think also for by-election, I think the current by-elections, we know the writ was moved on the two by-elections in Kingswood and Wellingborough. They're going to be on the higher spending limit, I think, as well. So we're going to get to see kind of how that goes as well. But Naomi, what have you kind of made of those changes, and what do you kind of think is the impact of those changes, not just in the amounts, but also who can spend the money as well, is the most important thing, right?
Well, it is. It's a very substantial increase. I know we've had a lot of inflation in this country. And, you know, you look at the price of tomatoes.
Yeah.
supermarket shelf, maybe it doesn't seem quite so huge
a rise.
But
to throw them at your politicians.
And you're right, yeah, so it's gone up from 19.5 million to nearly, well, 31.5. And then by-election spending limits, you mentioned we've got two, potentially three by-elections happening within the next couple of months. That's risen from 100 to 180. When we put it in historical context, it's the Conservatives that will get closer to the spending limit than other parties. So, you know, in 2019, they spent 16.5 million versus Labour's 12 million. They've also raised the threshold for when you have to report a donation. So we talk about who is funding our politics, which interests. Well, it used to be anything over £1,500 had to be reported to the regulator, the Electoral Commission. And that wasn't just if somebody had signed a cheque for £1,500. It was if they'd done three lots of £500 or a pound every month that had totaled up to £1,500. So, you know, pretty good. And that's now raised to £2,230. The other thing about who can vote in this election, which is different, is overseas Brits. So if you had been registered in the UK, but you moved abroad and you'd lived abroad for more than 15 years, you weren't eligible to vote in general elections. The UK Conservative Party have changed that. The government has changed it in the Elections Act. And so now they will be eligible. What comes with that eligibility is also the eligibility to donate and to be a permissible donor within UK elections.
Yep.
Why does that matter? Well, because when we look at who some of the major potential overseas foreign influence donors could be, well, generally that money goes into the Conservative Party. So again, a change that benefits them, probably to the detriment of other parties. And I don't think many British people expect foreign money to be influencing the outcome of democratic process in the UK.
Paying for leaflets or Facebook adverts for them.
Mm-hmm.
Alistair, the kind of transparency element of it, what have you kind of made of those changes, and what do you think about these the changes to this kind of who can donate money first of all,
let's go back just a few weeks to the way in which these changes were made. Look, I've been a Member of Parliament for 22 years. I thought I knew the procedure book inside out, upside down, back to front. I'm a recovering lawyer, so these things excite me. I had never seen this procedure used before. It wasn't even something on which we could call a vote in the House of Commons or the House of Lords. Mm. So, you know, it was the British constitutional equivalent of the executive order.
Mm.
Why did they do it? Well, we can see already why they can do it. They are awash with cash at the moment, and they are spending it as if it's gone out of fashion. That in itself should be setting alarms ringing. I think we need to look at the powers of the Electoral Commission, because the Electoral Commission, we know, are not happy about this. We know that it said that it risks diminishing an already low level of confidence in our political system.
But didn't the Election Act kind of take away some of their control?
Yeah, and I mean, if all
this
they
stuff.
Can do is sit and wring their hands on the sideline, what's the point of having an electoral commission? So I think, you know, we can pull it right back to that. And it does come back to the whole point about general political reform and concentrating power in the hands of a minority.
Michael Gove in this. The powers that are taken away from the Electoral Commission were given to him.
Yes.
By him.
Concentrating power in the hands of 40% is one thing. Concentrating power in the hands of Michael Gove.
Quite another.
That's quite another.
Yeah, Jess, what do you kind of made of the some would say the diminished role of the Electoral Commission, as Alistair says, they're very critical of these changes. They've been actually giving out much stronger comments than you would expect normally from the Electoral Commission. But that's partly because they've not got the power to reverse any of the changes or to influence those changes.
Sure, and they've been playing this crazy dance with government, where the government introduced this idea of government setting the strategy and policy of our independent elections body, which is just madness if you look at that. And then saying, but no, actually, we don't intend to set your strategy. We're having this strategy and policy statement that doesn't set your strategy and policy. And you're saying, but why have you got it then?
Yeah,
you
know, just in case we might want to.
Exactly, so that is the atmosphere that the Electoral Commission is working in at the moment. I think that's worth reminding ourselves. But again, thinking about what came through with the Election Act, the same week that bill came out, the Committee on Standards in Public Life set out a really, really in-depth, cross-party, well-researched report saying these are all the loopholes in our electoral financing. None of those suggestions made it into that bill. And the government hasn't taken seriously the electoral arrangements we're in at the moment and the massive loopholes that we're seeing. Things like unincorporated associations that can donate thousands without showing where that money came from. It doesn't even have to be made in this country. And that's not just a democratic concern, that's actually a security concern.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm really shocked that we haven't been paying more attention to this and the government hasn't been doing more about it.
I think that's a little bit ungenerous, actually. I think they have taken it very seriously. Having taken it seriously, they see it works massively to their advantage and they're not going to change it. You know, always remember, we live in a world where America sneezes and then 5 or 10 years later, Britain catches a cold. We've seen already what happens right across the United States with redistricting, limitations on who can register, where they can vote, and all the rest of it. And it's pretty clear that the Conservative Party in this country are just reading the playbook from the Republicans and the Tea Party movement in the States.
Mm. Just actually, on that thing we're going back to about the people living abroad who are able to vote, how are they physically going to cast their vote? Is it called the attestation process they're talking about using? How is that going to work, essentially?
How is it going to work? Yeah. I think this is going to put quite a lot of pressure on our already stretched electoral registration officers. And I have to say, there's nothing wrong with expanding the franchise per se, but I agree with Naomi about, you know, if you're not going to deal with the financial issues, then you've got to look at the connection between those two things. But we know that electoral registration officers are dealing with, you know, changes to postal votes, introduction of voter ID, and now this extension of franchise as well. So they could, you know, essentially be trying to find the previous registrations of a huge number of people going back quite a while.
3 million people, potentially, it could be, who've been living abroad for a long time.
Yeah, and they are, as many, many services are, really under financial pressure. And what really worries me about this, and lots of people have been saying, look, elections are a no-fail service, right? We can't turn around the next day and go, oh, we got that a bit wrong, yes, Let's have another bash. It has to go right, but we really need to be taking very seriously the warnings from Association of Electoral Administrators and others who are saying we are under enormous pressure and something at some point is going to crack in our system.
Yeah, I've heard of councils cancelling counting votes overnight because they don't want to pay people, they don't have the money to pay people to count votes overnight, so we'll not have that kind of usual election night service of him. We'll have to wait till the next day to see the kind of results come in. But also just having people who run the polling stations in where I live out in Kent, there's two ladies have run the polling station for like 50 years and they were really uncomfortable with dealing with the ID when we went there to vote in the local elections. And there's going to be lots of people up and down the country who don't want to then have to essentially be kind of a police inspector inspecting people's ID and checking for ID. They're not trained for that, or if they are, there's not a lot of money for that. Do you worry about kind of actually just the practical administration of a general election under these rules?
Absolutely, and particularly with voter ID, we're adding a lot of extra processes into a system. As you say, people don't want to be bouncers on the polling station. You know, it's supposed to be more positive than that.
Yeah, welcoming people into vote, yeah,
exactly.
Rather than turning them away.
But what's the impact for voters? And this is what we've always said about voter ID is you're really running a risk of damaging people's faith in our whole democratic process. If people turn up, there's a queue around the block, if people are prevented from voting, it makes people then question the result.
Yeah.
And Alistair just mentioned there about sort of taking inspiration from the US. The one bit of democratic thing we don't want to take from the US.
Exactly.
I mean,
they're still contesting the last election as we campaign for the current one.
It's a real risk.
Yeah. And so Naomi, then, I sort of jokingly said this episode was about sort of democracy in crisis. You know, I don't think it necessarily is in full crisis, but how do we improve that? And how do we, you know, we talk about turnout. I think there's fears that this could be a very low turnout election as well, given everything that we've discussed. How do we sort of improve that if we've got Rishi Sunak suggesting that, you know, best estimate will be later in the year, if we've got 8, 9, 10 months till an election? How do we improve that essentially ahead of an election?
Well, at Better Britain, we'll do a huge amount. We are a third party campaigner, which means we are registered with the Electoral Commission, but we can't spend anything near what the political parties can spend. So we'll be thinking about how we can spend our meagre sums in the most effective way. There are all sorts of issues to take into account, because if it's in term time, then it's should students be registered to vote in their university seat, or actually would their vote make more of a difference in their mum and dad's seat back from wherever they came from, because that's a more marginal constituency. So there'll be all sorts of things that different campaigns will be doing, both in terms of getting people registered to vote and turned out to vote. And where we'll be focusing most of our attention will be on tactical voting. So people that want change, but maybe don't know who they should vote for in order to get that, we'll give them that advice. I raise that because the Political Studies Association did a report in early 2022 that found most voters in England, not Scotland, they're much more politically switched on, cannot correctly identify who is in second place in their constituency. I've tested this on lobby journalists. I've said to them, where do you live? And who's your, do you know who your MP is? Which party they are? Usually they can get that.
Yeah, I know who is in mine, that's fine.
Who is second? They don't know. If you are steeped in Westminster politics and you don't know who the alternative to the party that's won your seat would be, what hope does the ordinary, busy, distracted person with
Look, we're back to the first-past-the-post system. You know, first-past-the-post, it concentrates the campaigning effort in a handful of marginal constituencies. Yeah. And if you live in a marginal constituency, then you will be carpet-bombed with election leaflets and emails and social media posts and the rest of it. And if you live in a safe seat, as I suspect quite a lot of these lobby journalists would do, then the significance of your local contest just falls off a cliff.
Yeah, yeah.
And frankly, it doesn't really matter if you're in a seat where either the Labour Party or Liberal Democrats or whoever is in second place, if they are 30-40% behind and that is of no significance.
Yeah, that kind of wasted vote that would go away with that.
We shouldn't have to have tactical voting because we should have equal votes.
One of the things I saw Taylor Swift tweeted about kind of getting people registered to vote, and I think the American system like crashed essentially when she did that. Do we need a kind of a figure like that to sort of get people to register to vote, to get people out to vote? And is that one of the big things that people can do to try and get rid of some of that democratic deficit ahead of an election?
Yeah, I mean, under the current arrangements, absolutely, you know, be encouraging people to register to vote. But we could just get rid of all of that altogether in one easy way by having automatic voter registration, which, again, the Electoral Commission have kind of recommended and given evidence of how it can be done. And we'd get rid of a huge democratic deficit. It's about 8 million people not on the register who could be. And all of that time and effort could be put then into getting people then out to vote and giving them the right information and actually enabling them to participate, rather than endless amounts of effort going into just putting people on the register in the first place. And also, it would save money. Where do you find a policy that saves money? You know?
On the point about Taylor Swift, I hear this a lot, but the UK is very, very different to the US. They've got this very, very binary system, and when you get popular celebrity figures encouraging young people to register to vote, you know how they're going to vote. In the UK, that is not quite so obvious. Some of those campaigns may end up causing a lot of young people to register to vote, who will then vote Green. Bless them, the Greens probably can only win in one, two, at a really good day, three seats. And potentially then stopping some Lib Dem victory or Labour victory somewhere else.
But so, also then feeling their vote didn't matter. What was the point of registering?
Exactly, and then you're... Exactly. I mean, it was 800,000 votes to get one Green MP at the last election. Yeah. So I don't think you can quite so easily transport all American campaigning techniques in the UK and expect the same result.
Look, anybody who runs that sort of campaign in this country with this system has to answer the question, well, why? What's the point? And, you know, the hard fact is that, you know, we have so many wasted votes and so much disengagement. I lived through the Scottish independence referendum and the Brexit referendum, and they were neither of them actually, regardless of the outcome, happy experiences. They were binary, they were divisive.
Yeah.
But they did achieve a phenomenal amount of turnout. And the people who were motivated to turn out in West Central Scotland, the northeast of England, places like that, where they had lived in safe seats forever and a day, were the people who had frankly thought there's no point in voting.
Yeah,
but well, suddenly we gave them an issue in which they cared about or were made to care, and they came out and voted.
Mm. I don't want to end on sort of a downbeat note. Can we have a little bit of optimism at all? Is it, Jessica, anything that we can say that, you know, any kind of hope as we head into this election year at all?
Well, there's an election, so there's always hope in an election, and not just keeping us all in business. My hope is in the people of the country, and I think things are changing. Things are changing rapidly. Volatility is going up. People are on the move. It's very febrile time. It's a difficult time, but within that, there's always change.
Mm.
And I think we will change. I am worried that we might change for the worse. I don't think we've perhaps seen the bottom yet, but that there's always opportunity, and there are enough people out there campaigning and putting all their time and energies into making democracy better that I feel that in time we'll end up on the right path.
Yeah, I think people are much more switched on to the need to vote tactically this time around because of the broken system, because they want that change. We polled it at the end of last year, 52% of people want to vote tactically, 38% of them to remove the government, 13% of them to keep the government. So I think Jess is right, we're in for change.
Hmm.
I'm old enough to remember the run-up to the 1997 general election, and I think it was one of the Dimblebys who said something that really stuck with me ever since. And he said, governments and babies' nappies need to be changed regularly and for much the same reason. And I think we are now coming up to one of these change elections. That gives us an opportunity,
yeah.
But it's no more than an opportunity. It's not just about how you elect people, it's what they do with the power then when they have it. And, you know, I hope that if nothing else, people might listen to this, would then think, well, how am I going to cast a vote and achieve an outcome? And maybe do more than cast a vote. Join a party, get out there, knock doors, deliver leaflets, whatever else, that is actually going to bring meaningful change that will be enduring beyond the next election.
That's all we've got time for this week, but you can read all the latest on the big stories from Westminster at politicshome.com and keep right up to date by subscribing to our 7-day newsletters by clicking on the link on our homepage. Thanks to my brilliant guests, Jess Garland, Naomi Smith and Alistair Carmichael. Thanks all again for listening. Please subscribe with your podcasts and leave us a review. If you want to get in touch, then reach out to us on Twitter at politicshome or email us via news@politicshome.com. But for now, I've been Alan Tolhurst and this has been The Rundown.